The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. I'm hoping today to connect to a really great guy in Australia, but we are having a little trouble getting through to him. So I'm going to speak to you today about something I've wanted to talk about for a long, long time, which is children, our children in America, and what we are putting them through as a nation. And I think it's one of the most destructive and tragic aspects of life in this country. And yet it could be one of the most wonderful things. We can get our acts together, and if we can begin to treat our kids the way they're supposed to be treated. To begin with, I want you to think about the human brain. I want you to think about it in a new way. So let's begin by not the human brain at all, but everything else. Think about what it's like to look at the stars, to think about the universe. When you put yourself in a position of laying back by yourself, you see stars, you see, hopefully you're imagining galaxies, you certainly see the Milky Way. You are aware of this huge space. You have some idea that we understand how that space out there works. You've heard of Kepler and Newton and Einstein. You know that there are principles that govern it in some sensible, rational fashion. Now imagine instead that while you're looking at the sky, you turn inward and you look at yourself. What are you going to see in there? What are you going to see in your brain, in your mind? Pretty much we don't see anything. It's hard to imagine what's going on in our brains. Might as well be a black hole. It's really difficult to grasp. So let's understand why it's difficult to grasp. Why don't we have a Newton? An Einstein. Why don't we have somebody like Galileo way, way back? Well, the answer is pretty surprising. And by the way, I see I have my guest, which is a great relief. But I'm going to go on and talk to you a little bit longer about this metaphor because it applies to everything. When you look in your brain and you don't see or understand anything, it's because we don't know anything. We don't have an Einstein because no one has come even remotely close to figuring out the operating system of the brain, if that analogy to computers even works. No one knows how the 100 million neurons and the trillion connections relate to each other. No one knows how they create a thought, a feeling, a concept, love, hate, let alone something as complex as madness or great sadness, which we call depression, or great distress in the form of anxiety. So psychiatry steps into this and just makes up stuff. But it's not neuroscience. When psychiatry says you have a biochemical imbalance, or that schizophrenia is a disease, we know it's a brain disease, Psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry is making it up. We don't know as much as a child tiptoeing on the edge of the ocean knows about the depths of the ocean. The whole system of psychiatry and its supposed basis in neuroscience is utterly fallacious. Now, this does give me an introduction to Tony Gee, who's waiting online. Tony, you there? Can Tony hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Good. Yes, I can.
Good.
Well, Tony and I share a great deal in the way we view things. I know we do because when he talks about his new organization in our newsletter, he's written a marvelous piece for the free newsletter of our organization that you can get at Bregan.com, or you can get it at empathictherapy.org. And by the way, while you're at it, get ready to come to our conference April 13th to 15th. And not knowing whether Tony was going to be here, I almost forgot to do my little intro on that. It's coming up, April 13th to 15th in Syracuse. Go to empathictherapy.org. Well, Tony wrote in our newsletter about using empathic therapy as a foundation for peer support for suicide of the bereaved. For really the bereaved by suicide. He's in Melbourne, Australia. He's a psychologist. His emphasis is on harm prevention and well-being. He's in private practice. He's developed a foundation called Life Is, and you can find him at lifeis.org.au. Well, one of the things that gives me a lot of gratification is that Tony lists my book, Heart of Being Helpful, as one of his inspirations and guides, in particular the concept of having a healing presence with other human beings. I think the future lies with the kind of program Tony is going to describe to you, because it totally bypasses, disregards the psychiatric viewpoint, and instead works from the viewpoint of peer help. And I'm going to hand it over now to Tony Gee from Australia. So glad you're here. Just tell us about your program or anything else you want as a start.
Yeah, sure, Peter. And look, can I say it's a privilege to meet you and to be on your program. So it's nice to know that it reaches the southern Netherlands. You know, from down in Melbourne, Australia. But it's lovely to meet you, and thank you for the invitation, Peter.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Yeah. Look, our program, as you describe it, is we've developed a, I guess you'd say it's a helping healing program, where families or people that have lost someone to suicide themselves, when they're further along the track, and perhaps have reached a point where they feel they would like to work with others or give something back to others, we match them in you know, we provide some training and so on, and as you've described, your principles around empathic therapy and certainly around healing presence are foundational to that training. And we match them with other families who have lost someone to suicide as a kind of a mentor or a peer support person to help them in their healing process, ongoing journey, you know, whichever way you'd like to call it. It's a voluntary program. Through our foundation and in partnership with another organisation, the Compassionate Friends, we received a small grant, which really set us off. But essentially, it's a voluntary program, and it's people helping people. But I guess the noble or the heart of peer support is it's people with a sort of a similar lived experience or some kind of lived understanding of the trauma, I guess you could say, that that matches and assists others. So that's our program. It's only small. We say we're a small but substantial organisation or small but substantial program. But as you say, it's a non-expert model. It's essentially human being to human being kind of model.
Tell me what your sense is of the concept of healing presence. Many people won't have read my book, and I think people could have very different ideas about it. So what's your sense of this concept of healing presence that you bring to the work?
Yeah, look, my sense, certainly in terms of the lived experience, my sense is it's actually... It's bringing something from within yourself, you know. It's bringing an intention. It's bringing a sense of inner connection. We'd call it empathic attunement, I think. I'm not sure whether you use that term, Peter, or not. But
no, I like it, though. I like it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In terms of that lived experience, there's an empathic attunement, and it's actually just bringing that to the situation or to the environment of being with the other. Look, sometimes it is. I mean, as you know, Peter, you know, if someone's in grief, it's almost a being there. But there are ways of being there. You know, there are ways of being there in a helpful kind of healing way, and perhaps not trying to do with. It's trying to be with. It's hard to explain, I find it a very interesting thing. I suppose you could say it's almost got some. It's bringing another dimension to it. We'd be very open to a spiritual dimension in terms of that healing presence, not in a overtly kind of religious in inverted commas way, but just recognizing that there can be other layers to this or other aspects to this that we're open to, you know, to bring to the relationship.
Oh, I think that's so real. And I think whether you're helping somebody as a peer or whether you love your children or your spouse, when you really are closely connected and empathic, most people feel a spiritual element to it. You know, we don't look into each other's eyes and say, oh, what pretty blue, and I can imagine your molecules bouncing around in some unique fashion. I mean, we really feel there's some real special meaning that surrounds relationship. And most of the people I know who seem to be good therapists or seem to have good love lives have that feeling of something sacred, something to be treasured, something spiritual surrounding human relationship. And I like the way you talk about healing presence, and I'm glad my concept helped give you some additional sense of it. Well, tell us some more about the program. How do you get in touch with these people? They reach out to you. You reach out to them.
A bit of both. You know, we call it an outreach program because often we find people might make a connection, or they might sort of. In an organisation, for example, we work with Compassionate Friends who have a grief line. Someone may ring in, and if they'd lost someone to suicide, we'll actually ring them back. We'll follow up and talk a little bit about the outreach program. We, sadly, in a sense, we get a number of people coming through word of mouth. Just someone knows someone, so they'll link them in with us. But we are an outreach program, which again is probably slightly different from what you get in inverted commas professional models. We actually go out to people. I'll often meet someone in a coffee shop, on a regular basis, and just sit down and talk with, be with. The volunteers will do the same. We find a lot of people who may be experiencing intense grief and so on, they won't reach out, or they won't If you hand someone a referral, they're not necessarily going to follow it up. So we're fairly active in terms of following things up with people. I'm often saying to people, I'm apologising for harassing them, you know, and they'll often laugh, and I'll say, look, we just have a clear deal, you know. I'll ring them on a regular basis, and when they're ready, they may meet up, but without exception, they say to me, we really appreciate your calls. We're not ready yet, or we just, you know, we're still struggling and so on, but we're really pleased to know that someone is there or a group is there that we'll link up to at some stage. So it's really an active outreach kind of procedure.
Yeah, Can you describe a relationship, you know, disguising it obviously, that you've had or one of the people you work with has had, so we can get an idea of the frequency and intensity of this visiting together?
Yeah, look, it's sometimes, like for example, we have a lady who I was recently talking to who's in a fairly isolated part of Tasmania, which is even further south. Little island sort of south of Australia
place. I have a friend who's told me about it.
Yeah, it's a fairly wild place, and but she has really no support mechanisms there. So we'll regularly touch base with her by phone. It could be once a week, once every couple of weeks. It's a strange thing, Pete, and that's what I really appreciate about your willingness and ability to try and, it's almost capture the uncapturable in terms of that healing presence. You know, it's not therapeutic in inverted commas again, or not, you know, not focused as a sort of a traditional therapy, but it's extremely therapeutic for people. And you know, it's not necessarily once a week. Often the visits or the catch-ups will be once a month. But I think it links people who are struggling and in many ways can be quite isolated. It links them with the community. Even if that community, like if there's a woman in, you know, in Tasmania who gets a phone call or talks to someone every few weeks, she's still linked with the community. And I think it's that part of it that's so, again, it's difficult to necessarily capture all of that in some clear methodological kind of study, but we know that's the way it works.
Well, I'm really with you. I mean, that was my first experience when I was a college student and I walked into the state mental hospitals. I mean, it was just clear to me that people needed a relationship and it had something to do with love. And I'm not much better at describing it now than I was then, maybe a little better. But there is something that people get when they engage each other and know someone cares about what's happening to them.
That's right. And I think in our sort of Western scientific, almost linear world, we forget some of those really basic principles of human help and human care. That's what we thrive on, I think. But you don't see that articulated in a number of, say, in academic journals. Unfortunately, sometimes you do.
Rarely, even in psychology or social work, you rarely see that. And therapy is taught as a rote procedure all the time. You know, I have a video tape that people can buy online from Bregan.com where I try to show my style of being a human being with another human being, and it's going to be everybody's style different. And when students look at that, they're really shocked because they've been taught to do very stereotypical, repetitious kinds of questioning and answering. And I'm totally with you on what you're saying. Now,
human connection ultimately, you know, but unfortunately, Peter, again, as you articulate at times, it's almost like the aspirin of good therapeutic work. No one can copyright that or market it. In, you know, it's not a new technique sort of thing that can be, you know, can be sold. And I think we lose track of those simple fundamentals that really do, that people need, we all need, and that assists in our kind of healing stuff.
Definitely. Now, in your program, where these are people who don't view themselves as professional, can the peer become a friend, a best friend, a really good friend, outside the whole context of the program?
Yes. I think in many ways that happens. You know, I think it's not it's part of that linking to a community. There's a peer community, you know, that is developing through life is. It's developing through the, or it's developed through the compassionate friends. So yes, people do really have long-term kind of connections and friendships, but it's linking into the community. It's almost like that community becomes the ongoing heart of care. And I mean, that community will remain. I might come and go, or someone else might come and go, but that sense of community will remain and sustain. It's linking someone into that. But you're absolutely right. People do become friends too, which probably is not professional in inverted commas, but again, it's just part of that world, I suppose, we're trying to develop here.
Yeah, I love what you're doing. I'm asking these questions because I think we need to understand what the distinctions are. Now, in a professional relationship, a counseling relationship as I conduct it, and it'll be interesting to hear how you conduct your private practice counseling and what the contrast might be. But yeah, one of the things that makes a counseling relationship work in contrast to a peer relationship is the limits you set on yourself. So you don't relate to the person in a coffee shop. You don't go into any kind of extracurricular activity with the individual. And above all else, you don't have a romantic or sexual relationship with the individual. Is any of that taken into consideration, including the big taboo of sex? Or is it, if you're peers, you develop your relationships as you spontaneously want to?
Yes. Look. Certainly that's taken into consideration, and probably without, you know, in part of the training we talk about boundaries still, and you know, and ethics, you know, like certain things you mentioned, you know, where boundaries can easily be crossed, and I think it's probably a little more difficult or a little less clear in peer relationships.
Right.
I can only say I experienced so far that no one has crossed those boundaries, and we do screen people coming into the program fairly well as peer supporters or as someone being supported, you know, and I offer, because of my professional background, I offer really a sort of a, well, we call it peer vision. It's kind of like a supervisory role, but yeah, I think there are issues there, and again, I think the boundary stuff around peers is less clear than around a sort of a counselling relationship.
Well, it sounds like people are automatically, though, respecting kind of the sacred task they have, which is to be there for the other person, because as you say, they're not developing those relationships as of yet. And it's, I think, a common sense. It's interesting for me. I've never thought through this. Tony Gee, this is really interesting for me.
Me too, Peter. We're dealing with this ourselves, you know.
Because, you know, even common sense would say, if you've just met a man or a woman who has lost someone to suicide or any other severe bereavement, you wouldn't want to move in right away with a romantic relationship anyway, because you'd feel like maybe you were taking advantage, or maybe the emotions were too raw. So common sense and general respect for another person would lead you to be cautious.
Yes. No, look, I think you're quite right. And I like your use of the term that there is a sense of sacred space around this, or again, there's a higher purpose around this. The relationships that develop, or the friendships, or the peer connections that develop, they're specifically around healing. They're specifically around trying to assist, or enable or augment another person's healing and one's own too. It's a two-way relationship. We don't explicitly talk about the nose, but we talk about boundaries and ultimately it's care of the other, but thankfully we haven't had an instance of boundaries being crossed in any way. But we're a small program. I think if it grew, there's always, I think the bigger one gets, the harder it is to perhaps contain or get a handle on everything that's occurring in it, and issues may arise. Again, I can only say that we haven't had any negative experiences so far of cross boundaries.
Maybe you could begin to think about how you could develop your organization in small pods, so that the group wouldn't get bigger than 15 or 20 or something like that. That was the center for people's activities. I mean, these are all interesting issues. See, what you're doing, basically, anybody can do. There's no rules out there in America that say, oh, wait a minute, this comes under public health, or this comes under this, or this comes under that. Now, if the movement got big, then I'm sure the government would decide that it had some rules. Yes. But it seems to me that this would not fall under the usual problems of licensure and state supervision that we have in this country over almost anything useful and interesting. Tell us about selection, Tony, a little bit about selection of people.
The selection is really some people who've tapped on the shoulder who have already been involved in groups and so on for suicide bereaved. We don't. One of our rules, and I mean, as we talk, it reminds me of things, Peter. Like, this is very grassroots. It's almost developing from the bottom up rather than the top down. Do you know what I mean? It's an organic, sort of an organic program that will keep developing. But one of our rules is someone needs to be have been bereaved for, in a sense, more than 2 years, so that they're at least a significant
2 years from their own bereavement.
From their own bereavement, so they can have, and why hesitate? For some people, 2 years is nothing. For others, 2 years seems a long time. But we've just drawn an arbitrary line, really around from some of our experience, but also some of the literature, which says 2 years down the track, people can often just step back a little from their own story, and they're able to, involve with, work with another story. So people need to be had their loss over 2 years ago. They also need to have done a little bit of training around either working with groups or working with people, and they need to be prepared to go through our training process, which isn't rigorous, but again, we're using your principles around empathic therapy, and we talk about developing peer conversations, a model of the conversational model of peer support, which is non-threatening, but so people need an ability to be involved in training and make a commitment to the program for at least a period of time. We have ongoing development days, we have ongoing discussion afternoons, where we'll have kind of in inverted commas case discussion, or talk, people can bring any issues they have to the table, and we talk those through. So we're fairly
wonderful, Tony. I really really like what you're saying. Do people, how many hours of training do people have?
Look, it varies. A number of the people that we started off with had done a peer support group leader training, which was run through Compassionate Friends.
Okay.
That would be, that's probably about 20 hours of training. Others, our own training, we start off with a day, which is, 8 hours, and then we build on that. So it's again that ongoing kind of I guess the training's ongoing, So
yeah, Tony, we're going to go to break now. When we come back, I'd like to continue talking about this program and how it really could maybe be applied to every area of what we call loosely mental health. And I'm talking to Tony Gee, G-E-E, from Melbourne, Australia. You can reach Tony at lifeis.org.au. Let's go to music and break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. It's also known as the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour. And my guest, Tony Gee from Melbourne, Australia. I know a lot of really good people in Australia. Tony, I don't think you're making it to our conference this year, are you?
No, look, we would love to come, Peter. And we're planning to, things didn't work out, and if you can have one closer to Australia, that would be wonderful sometime.
Well, we are planning to do some conferences in cooperation with other groups and organizations, because we really believe that it's just not about one group. It's about transforming the way we view emotional suffering on this planet. Yep. So Ginger, my wife Ginger, and I are really working on trying to find coalitions to hold conferences and really spread this word in a more thorough way. So maybe something will come up, maybe something in Australia. I do think the work you're doing is one of the potential salvations in our field. Really have to break the biological psychiatric model, and to a great extent in certain areas at least, we got to break the professional model. I think there's room for a professional model. I'm a professional. I love doing therapy. I do help people. I see good counselors everywhere I go, good therapists, but we'll never be enough. And there are some folks who don't want professional counseling. I think that peer counseling has to become just a bigger and bigger phenomena, and it can be done so much more easily, so much more cheaply, so much less cost, if any, to the person who gets the service. So I'm just delighted with what you're doing. Tony, is there any direction you'd like to take the conversation in right now?
Sorry?
Is there any direction you'd like to take the conversation in?
Well, actually, just to mention, to build on what you were saying, I absolutely agree, Peter, and it's not to say, obviously there's a large place for professional and a need for professional intervention, but unfortunately I think we've really underestimated the power of peer support, of community support, of like-minded people supporting one another. And there's such a large pool of people out there who are incredibly competent, helpful, and can bring healing presence to, to relationships, to interactions. And we've just not clicked down on that. I know one of your earlier studies that you talk about in toxic psychiatry, when you with, students just went into a psychiatric ward and just brought a presence to people, worked with people. What an enormous difference that made to lives. And I'm staggered how that doesn't get picked up and supported. And I mean, I have my own thoughts about that. But that was a peer support model in a sense, you know, I mean, professionally in some ways, but it's really people connecting with people. And I would agree with you. I think that's where change will need to come from, because we can't afford the professionals anyway, not as a total professional model of care. We're going to have to look to our community, ourselves.
Well, you know, they could eventually shut down our program after, I think, a decade or more of being in existence after I left. But they could shut it down because it was dependent on the psychiatric hospital. You're going to have a little more trouble shutting down your kind of program because it doesn't pretend to be a part of the health system. But we'll see what you run into. As you become successful, they will try to stop you.
Yeah, well, it will be, we're small. We perhaps would be described as perhaps an itch in some quarters at the moment. But we'll see. If we grow into an ache, then we might I might take notice. And then I assume, well, we'll see what happens there. I hope they don't. But Peter, also in terms of what you're saying, if we'd like to raise, I think. We've actually developed a charter, or part of a number of organisations here in Melbourne. We've developed a charter of peer support, and
that's going to help you when you come under attack.
It will, and that was for that very reason, to actually have a strength in numbers. There were seven organisations involved in developing that, and also to clearly articulate the sorts of principles that we were basing our programs on, and that they're remarkably consistent with your principles around empathic therapy, Peter, which was so heartening, and again, part of our, decision, to use your work as foundational to some of our training and, some of our developing our processes. I can give people a website for that if they're interested in it. And even if your centre was interested, we're looking for endorsements for that too, Peter. So it may be something to look at if your centre was open to endorse the charter. But I can
Tell
give you that later
it.
If you like, or...
What is the website?
It's www.peersupportvic.org.
And Peer Support Vic.
Yep.
Is that
for Victoria? Peersupportvic.org.
But is it .au if we're coming from the US?
No, it's just .org, I think. I'm just trying to look at it now and. Yeah, I think it's just .org, so it must be a blanket one.
Yeah, that's fabulous. If this program were in the U.S., every single person practically who you reached out to would be on antidepressant drugs, making them worse and making it harder for them to have their feelings and work their way through. Is that so in Australia, too? I mean, are most of these folks getting antidepressants?
I think, thankfully, we're still a number of years behind the US. I'd say it is an issue, but a number of people who come to us will have seen their GPs and so on, and often the GP will just recognise that this is grief. You need to work with someone around your grief without... I think the biological model, it's very entrenched in Australia, but perhaps not quite so pervasive. So some people, yes, will have the antidepressants to deal with their emotions. The majority, I would say, no. And there's a bit of a, I can't talk too broadly, Peter, but I think we're less of a pill culture in Australia. Slightly less. I think there's still huge issues here. And again, we welcome your leadership in terms of, articulating the dangers, but also the alternatives, and but yeah, probably not as much as there would be in the States.
Would you like to talk some about your counseling and and how your practice is and how it might relate to these experiences as peer and peer yes. counseling?
Yeah, I'd love to, Pete. Look, I should say, I never quite know where to... I should have said this at the outset. I sort of wear two hats in a lot of the work that I do, and I seem to manage to work between it. But I lost my youngest daughter to suicide in 2005, and
oh dear God, how old was she?
Yeah, she was 15.
Oh dear God.
Yeah, very young, and I guess in a sense that really. You know, after I'd worked through my own grief stuff, which doesn't go away too, it's still there, but, you know, that changes over time. But that's what catapulted me into really working in the field of harm prevention, suicide prevention, postvention. But also, I found that some of the supports that were helpful to me came from professional quarters. But really, the majority of support or where I felt most at home was amongst peers. So that's, I guess, this program grew out of my experience, but also the experience of others that I've met in the sort of community, I suppose, of suicide bereaved. So in my counselling practice, I kind of wear two hats, I suppose. I'm still very much work as a professional, inverted commas, but I guess there's for some of the clients that I'd see, you'd say there's perhaps a different connectedness, particularly those that have come to see me because they've lost someone to suicide and are looking at coming to terms with that, or often say our language is really inadequate when we describe these things, but just in ways that they can manage from here. So I've got part of my passion, Peter, is to see what we can shift. Not just my daughter, also I should say, was involved in the psychiatric system, and I have lots of issues still around her care, and also the medications and so on. Again, I welcome your work that articulates some of those huge issues that that are there in our system.
Tony, how long ago was this that she died?
7 years ago, Peter, 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And yes.
Thank you for telling us about that.
Yeah.
It brings up an issue I've wanted to bring up in our conversation, which is, we are all peers. I mean, all human beings are peers. We all have suffered. We all have experiences that we blame ourselves for, that we have to struggle with. We all suffer. And I think that one of the things that, for whatever reason, distinguished me when I went into the state hospitals as a college student was that I had no highfalutin thoughts that I was better than anybody in the state hospital. I just thought I was a lot luckier.
Yeah.
I had that feeling of there, but for the grace of God go I. And I think that that's how all good counseling and help, official, unofficial, peer, or professional, has to come from that sense of there, but for the grace of God go I, or maybe there I've gone before. And I
yes.
could be there right now.
Yes.
And
yes.
I just think that's so basic to all
yes.
solid and sound human relations.
I would absolutely agree, Peter. And I think that sense of, we're lucky enough at times down here. We've just had a tour of some Native American healers, I guess. But they're Native American Western-trained doctors, one's a psychiatrist, but also healers in their own community. And they have a term, which is Mitakwaye Oyasin. I probably pronounce that very poorly, but it's to all my relations. And in a sense, in that worldview, we are all related. We are all relations. Some of us have different experiences, but fundamentally, we are all related. And I think in some of our Western psychiatric models, we forget exactly what you're saying, Peter, that you know, we almost forget that we're fellow human beings who have different experiences at different times, but we're all peers. We're all related.
So, well, this conversation could never occur in a psychiatric setting. And barely could it occur in any professional. I think the nearest place, I think maybe some counseling departments in the United States have maintained their humanity, and maybe an occasional humanistic psychology group, but there aren't many of them, that one could even begin to have this conversation. Maybe with Adlerians. I recently spoke to Adlerians, and I'm looking forward to doing some more Adlerian conferences, because they so deeply believe in the communality of human nature and human needs.
And perhaps the Rogerian.
We just need to keep reminding folks, it's not about me diagnosing you and me fixing you. Yeah. It's about a relationship in which we find out what you need and how you can get it, and without any pretense of superiority.
I love that conception too around wounded healers, because I think certainly for many, but we're all wounded healers in some ways, and it's the wounding that assists us in our healing. It assists us in our understanding, because that's the empathy, I think. And it's sad people like yourself, Peter, have to remind everyone so much about being empathic, especially in the helping profession. One would think that's just the given. That's the foundational gift. But unfortunately, it's not.
Well, I like so much what you just said, because it was actually on my mind at the moment. And that is that we're all wounded healers. Been asked to write a chapter in a book about wounded healers. And my view is, we're all wounded healers. This is just basic. Human beings are wounded. This is just basic.
That's right. Show me anyone who hasn't had their own trauma, in a sense, in life, in some respects. I struggle to come across them.
But you do have a professional practice. You do charge people.
Yes. People make appointments. We have our kind of hour, and I guess that's, I would say my main approach, Peter, is around, empathic therapy, that connecting. Also, that I work in a collaborative way, which really is that, two of us work together here, but it's the focus is on the person's particular issues or life issues or the sorts of things that they wish to shift, change. And again, I think, as you point out in the heart of helping is that I have particular skills and expertises, some from my personal experience, but from my training that I bring to that relationship, and will assist people in strategies, techniques, and so on. But fundamental to it is the connectiveness, and that it's collaborative. It's two people trying to work out what's going to help here.
I love your bringing up my book, The Heart of Being Helpful. It's in many ways my favorite book. People get to know me and Ginger through the book. And not a lot of folks have read it. I'm better known for my critiques of psychiatry. So maybe some folks will get that book and enjoy it.
No. I would highly recommend it to anyone. And we use that again as foundational to the training that we do as in peer support, because it almost articulates some of the principles that I think others find it difficult to articulate, Peter. So that's why we like that so much. And I think, as you said earlier, that sense of being able to bring something other to the relationship, the spiritual, the sacredness. I think it's sad that I could count on the one hand the amount of perhaps books I've read around psychology, psychiatry. That's, some will talk about the spiritual, like it's there. I think people that practice with other people know that it's there at times. You have to be aware, open to that.
Do you work at all in groups? I've always found for myself it's hard to create the environment I want when there's several people competing for attention. I'm just not up to it. Have you been able to bring a healing aura healing presence, to working in groups?
Look, thank you for that question. I sort of forget. Look, I've run a group for several years now for men. They're bereaved fathers, and it's a really interesting group because, again, while we may not articulate those sorts of principles, I think clearly that's what's, you know, been brought to the group. And through just, it's hard to say, it's perhaps just through the nature of the group, you know, there's about, we have up to 14, 15 guys and who are regular attendees once a month, but it's really, it's a quite a remarkable supportive and nurturing space that's developed. There are ups and downs with it at times, but it's just kept going, you know, which is an unusual thing. I haven't been able to find another group. I think there was one in Boston I found on the internet, but to get a group of men together is unusual and successful. So it's worked in that environment, Peter, but I'm not exactly sure why, you know. We run another program, we call it Spirituality, Grief and Healing. It's for bereaved parents, basically, and that's a fairly new group. We get about a dozen regular people to that. But I must say that has a presence, like a really clear presence to it. And again, we haven't sat down and said this is the way we're going to function. It seems to have come probably from the subject matter. I mean, generally in these two groups, it's someone who has lost a child or a sibling or someone very close. So that perhaps that brings a different air to it and you know, perhaps more of a sense of that sacred or spiritual. You know, they're two examples I can think of, but I think they're probably unusual groups.
Mm-hmm. Tony, you're probably aware of this absurdity that's going on now with the DSM-4 or 5. Yeah. It's going to be 5 about making bereavement a disorder.
Yeah. Look, it frightens me in a sense, Peter. As you were saying before, I think one of the riders to it has been, look, this doesn't mean, you know, if someone has a bereavement disorder that, you know, the treatment will be medication. But I suspect that's just the way it will go.
Of course it will. That's the only reason to put it in. All the guys who work on that stuff are people who are mostly guys who are, you know, and tied to the drug company.
Yeah.
So drug companies massively. Yeah. So that's the purpose of it.
It frightens me a bit, and again, it kind of it pathologizes grief, and you know, sure, people can get stuck in grief. I've worked with people that are stuck, but I think stuck in grief is different than having a bereavement disorder or a mood disorder. I forget exactly what the classification will be. And stuck in grief requires a different way of working with, I think, than diagnosis and treatment. But yeah, I find the whole DSM concerning, Peter. Anyway, again, it's another reason why I really like your work. Thank you for what you articulate on behalf of many of us.
Gosh, you know, you and I would be good friends, I think, Tony. It's just such an easy thing to talk with you. Let's try to do it long distance. Let's try not to do what I tend to do all the time, which is just drop contact. So let's really try to stay in touch. I love what you're doing. I like the way you think about things, and I think the future lies very heavily in the directions that you're moving in. I think it's very, very important.
Look, I thank you very much, Peter, and I would love to stay in touch. And if you were looking at trying to do anything down under, you know, that what we could assist with, and would love to get to your conference, but unfortunately not able to, but sometime we might be able to get over to your part of the world and, you know, would love to sit down and talk further.
Well, our aim is to more and more try to develop conferences that are multi-sponsored so that we're not just talking to the same group but are just bringing more and more people under this umbrella of empathic therapy with all the varied and different approaches. Tony, 20 seconds, something you'd like to say goodbye to this audience, who I'm sure is really enjoying you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Peter, and thank you to listeners. And if anyone wants to follow anything up that we've discussed, either through you or contact me, very happy to. And I really look forward to further conversations.
Is the best way just to go to lifeis.org, AU, or do you want to give an
email?
That's
probably the best way to get hold of me, if there's any queries.
That's lifeis.org. And you've been listening to psychologist Tony Gee. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, who has very much enjoyed being in the healing presence and company of my new friend, Tony Gee, far away in Australia. I hope you've enjoyed this show as much as I have.
Thank you very much, Peter.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.